behavior and feelings. Dr. Kelly Posner-Gerstenhaber, professor of psychiatry at Columbia University, founder and director of the Columbia Lighthouse Project. If you or someone may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd at 10 a.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. The Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair features government, nonprofit, and private sector employers from around the Pacific Northwest who are looking for employees. Again, that's the Urban League Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock. Coming up next, Abe and Joe cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your dial. This is Talk Radio with Abe and Joe. And I might add, that's Abe Proctor, and I'm Joe Uris.
Yeah, that's true.
231-8187.
So far, our show is entirely factually correct.
So far.
We'll keep it that way.
Hopefully.
Or we'll do our best. You can reach us on the phone, and I hope you do today, because we've got a lot to talk about. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Also, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/AbeandJoe, or over the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Today we're going to talk about something we've been wanting to talk about for several weeks now, but it's sort of been shunted aside due to
crazy
the strangeness of current events, you might
crazy.
Say. So what we're going to talk about is we are going to compare and contrast the contents of President Trump's proposed 2020 budget with the contents of the proposed Green New Deal legislation.
Crazy. I also want to add that a lot of people call them real regular, and we welcome them. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to hear new voices, particularly women's voices.
Yep. Yeah, that's sort of a standing call.
We do
appreciate our regular listeners, regular callers. Please don't misunderstand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just that it becomes kind of a trialogue or something like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think our job is best served by a multiplicity of voices taking part in the conversation.
Yes, and by the way, if you think we're full of it, mm-hmm. you can say so.
Yeah, yeah.
Only you can't use it.
Right. So we're going to talk about Trump's budget and the Green New Deal. Spoiler alert! One of them is really dumb. Okay. But before we get to that, I imagine many of you tuned in this morning thinking that we might devote this show to talking about the non-release of the Bob Mueller investigation.
Too early.
The report about Bob Mueller's investigation into the alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government.
Not alleged. I don't buy alleged.
Well, you know, technically that's the case.
Yeah, right? But I don't buy that.
So we're not going to talk about that today.
No.
For the simple reason is that nobody's actually read the report. Nobody that matters has actually read the report.
And they're not letting
nobody
us.
In the general public has actually read the report.
We're not going to get to.
The collective paroxysm that's taken over the Beltway and the media is all based on absolutely nothing because nobody has actually read the report. All everybody's talking about is this four-page summation, this letter that was sent by the Attorney General, William Barr, to Congress.
A creep.
Talking about the basically the top-line conclusions from the report.
By the way, when I say he's a creep, I'm tired of being nice to these guys. Mm-hmm. This government is a kleptocracy. It's an incompetent bunch. Trump always hires people who are dumber than he is, and he's stupid.
It's true.
It's really true.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that one of the maxims of success? One of the tenets of successful people? Surround yourself with people dumber than you? Isn't that how it goes?
No, that's the opposite of how it's supposed to go.
Okay, so... like I said, we're not going to talk about the non-release of the Mueller report.
But we will talk about it as soon as it actually is available.
Right. But I do want to say just a couple things in passing before we get going. This is one of the most annoying things that has come in front of my eyeballs as a self-appointed political and social commentator here on KBOO. I mean, this is just surpassingly dumb. All right, here's basically what happened. William Barr is telling us, okay? He's telling us.
The flack.
Right, the flack, the attorney general. The guy who applied for his job basically by sending an unsolicited memo to the Justice Department stating his opinion that the president cannot be indicted, nor can a sitting president obstruct justice. And so, of course, the Trump administration says, you sound like our guy. You're the next attorney general.
Right.
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 So he is basically telling us, he's summarizing the report saying, there are no further indictments coming out of the Mueller investigation. Everybody who's going to be indicted it's already come out. There's going to be no further indictments. That means Don Jr. is off the hook. That means that the president himself is off the hook. It's all the people whom we were really hoping would be in the crosshairs of this investigation, according to Attorney General Barr, are not in the crosshairs of this investigation. See, this is very similar to what used to happen when I was in grade school and I would get a report card. And instead of giving the report card to my parents, I would give them a summation of its contents and say, hey, this is what's in the report card. I'm not going to share it with you, but you're just going to have to trust me.
How come they let you do that?
And everything worked out fine. It was great.
Sure.
Nothing to see here. Move along. So no more indictments coming out of the Mueller investigation. Also, apparently, according to Barr, Mueller declined to conclude whether the president and his campaign and his staff had obstructed justice. Apparently, in the report, he puts out the evidence, but he leaves it for others to draw the conclusion as to whether justice was, in fact, obstructed, right? So what did Attorney General Barr and his deputy, Mr. Rosenstein, do? They looked at that evidence, this is what they're telling us anyway, and concluded, no, justice was not obstructed. End of story. So now, everybody is losing their collective heads, including most of the mainstream media. I'm sure you will not be surprised to see this. I'm not surprised to see it either. What I am is really disappointed. How can they be such suckers? They are just swallowing this hook, line, and sinker. Oh, we're going to believe everything the attorney general tells us, even though we haven't seen this report.
Even though he's the worst attorney general, even than the one before him.
Yep. And you know what's happening again? At the New York Times, which is particularly disappointing, is we see a chasm between what the news division at the New York Times is reporting on the front page of the paper and what the editorial board is writing in the interior of the paper. The editorial board is remarkably clear-eyed about all this, saying, hey, this means nothing. Show us the report. Whereas on the front page, it's all about how the president has been exonerated completely about this. So it's really pretty much a circus, all based on absolutely nothing. But we're not going to talk about that today.
It's a nothing sandwich.
It is a nothing sandwich, but we're not going to talk about it.
No.
Okay.
With stale bread,
yeah. So more about this when we actually have something to discuss. And pay no attention to the circus happening in your newspapers and on your TV.
Even though the Wallandas fell off the wire.
The what? What?
The Wallandas. Never mind.
Okay, good. I won't. Good. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This, of course, is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. Let's get down to business, shall we?
Okay.
Okay. As we said at the outset, we want to compare and contrast two radically different documents and discuss how the vision they lay out for the future of the United States is also radically different. So let's start with the bad stuff first, shall we?
Okay.
Okay. Trump, a few weeks ago, submitted his proposed budget for the fiscal year beginning 2019-2020.
Yeah. It's not really a budget, but go ahead.
Well, you know it is, right? It describes his priorities. It says, "What? Here's where I want to cut things. Here's where I want to increase spending. Here's what I want to do.
It's magic just like the tax cut.
No, it's not magic just like the tax cut. There's nothing magical about this, Joe. If you believe this is magic, my friend, you have a profoundly jaded outlook on the universe.
Well, I
really hope that you learn to enjoy yourself before it's too late.
I really do.
Because there's nothing at all magical about this. And as Dr. King said many decades ago, and what I think is a pretty profound statement, he said, budgets are moral documents. Budgets indicate what the extent and the scope of one's moral priorities. And if that's true, and I believe that it is, then Trump's budget indicates that he's not a very moral person.
You think?
I think we could call it shorthand. We could call it the Medicare for None budget.
Yes.
Can we call it that?
Yes, let's call it
that. I'm going to briefly review what's in it.
Okay.
And this is really to set up the contrast with the Green New Deal that we're going to talk about here in a moment. Trump's budget proposes $1.5 trillion in cuts to Medicaid over 10 years.
Wait. Cuts to Medicaid?
$1.5 trillion in cuts to Medicaid. Medicaid, of course, being the federally funded health care program for the poor, the very poorest among us.
Well, the poor. Who?
Yeah. Right. This will happen over 10 years. It'll also implement work requirements for recipients of Medicaid.
Like if you're really laid up or broken or whatever, you have to go to work?
Yeah, you're just lazy and you're not going to get any health care.
Really?
Unless you get up and go to work.
Yeah.
It also eliminates the expansion of Medicaid, which is one of the cornerstones of the Affordable Care Act passed under the Barack Obama administration. And instead, it adds something called $1.2 trillion for something called a market-based health care grant.
What is that?
Nobody really knows. It's sort of a big block grant to states, which is a big change in the way Medicare funds are allocated or Medicaid funds are allocated. Now, right now they go to various administrative districts based upon the need that's present there. Now they're saying we're just going to give them states a bunch of money and let them spend it as they see fit. Do you have any confidence in the state governments in the old Confederacy, for example, spending that money wisely, Joe?
Well, gee, I don't know. I think the guys in the state governments in the Confederacy.
No, the answer is no. We don't have confidence in them. Trump's budget also includes an $845 billion cut to Medicare over 10 years. That's about a 10% cut to this incredibly necessary system we have to provide health care to people over 55.
Hey, that's me.
That's you, yes. That also is about a 10% cut. He says he's going to achieve this through targeting wasteful spending and payments to care providers and lowering the cost of prescription drugs.
Wait a minute. You mean like the nice people who come and help you when you're unlucky or unhealthy, and they come and they help you with your household and your...
Well, those two, and the actual doctors that treat people over 55. Those are care providers.
Well, fortunately, doctors don't care about how much they make.
Yeah. Well, and also nurses and x-ray techs and lab techs and everybody else.
Yeah.
Right? 10% cut to be achieved through lowering payments to those people.
Oh, they'll love that.
Now, here's what happened. This is a phenomenon that's happening now and has been happening for some time in this era of conservative opposition to programs like Medicare, which is pretty much my entire adult life, that when payments to care providers are cut back, many physicians elect not to participate in Medicare. So what this means is that there will be more of those physicians who say it's not worth my time to provide Medicare because I'm not getting adequate reimbursement from the federal government. So that means people are going to have to go without care where they might have otherwise had it. That's the Medicare for None budget proposed by President Trump. Also, he says he's going to achieve the savings by lowering prescription drug costs, which is an interesting conundrum because, if you'll all recall, during the George W. Bush administration, the Republicans passed, in a really crazy set of circumstances, something called the Medicare Part D law. Do you remember this?
I do.
Yeah, this was hailed as a remarkable act of enlightenment by a Republican Congress because finally, at long last, the cost of prescription drugs would be covered under Medicare.
Yeah.
But it also guaranteed that American pharmaceutical manufacturers would continue to make the incredibly obscenely large profit margins that they have enjoyed forever and ever and ever.
You know, my aunt,
yeah,
may she rest in peace, pointed out to me 20 years ago how corrupt the pharmaceutical industry was.
Did Is she?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Smart lady.
Yeah, it is incredibly corrupt. And they enjoy some of the largest profit margins of any industry anywhere in the world.
In fact, the whole smack epidemic of now is due to the pharmaceutical industry.
It is, yes. So it's interesting that he's proposing lowering the cost of prescription drugs when this big landmark piece of legislation was passed to ensure that they would be as expensive as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting to see how he squares that circle.
Oh.
He also proposes in his budget $25 billion in cuts to Social Security over 10 years.
$25
billion? Yep, including cuts to disability insurance.
Oh, well.
$220 billion cut to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. That's food stamps, over 10 years.
You know, if you don't feed people enough, they get stupid.
Yeah, this also includes work requirements for people who receive food assistance.
Where are the jobs?
What's that?
Where are the jobs?
I don't know.
Is there a jobs program?
It doesn't matter, Joe. All that matters is that these lazy freeloaders work. That's all it matters.
Rah, rah, rah.
The program right now, just to give you an idea of the scope of this, serves around 45 million people.
Whoa.
All right. A $21 billion cut to temporary assistance for needy families. This is what we generally term as welfare.
Right.
$207 billion in cuts to the federal student loan program.
Yes, yeah, we don't
including
need those.
Eliminating the public service loan forgiveness program.
Wow.
Yeah.
So indebted for the rest of your life?
Indebted for the rest of your life, yeah. And no chance to have part of that loan forgiven because you decided to devote your career to public service.
Right.
None of that, yeah. Fortunately, thank God, it increases the Pentagon budget by $34 billion next year alone.
I feel safer already.
This would be the largest defense budget in the history of the United States, about 5% higher than it is right now. This, of course, is in order to protect us from the many enemies who are threatening our borders at every turn.
Right, and we're going to arm space.
And we're going to arm space. Thank you for reminding us of that. It also includes, hey, $8.6 billion for a southern border wall.
The wall.
Yeah. This is going to be paid for.
Does that include the cages?
The cages?
Yeah.
One would assume, right?
Yeah.
Because I guess we have to conclude at this point that forcibly separating children from their families is part of the United States foreign policy right now.
Yeah.
That's just what we do.
Come across, we lock you up.
Yeah, we imprison children in cages at the southern border of the United States because that's just what we do. That's what good Americans do. And that's what our president is calling for more of. Overall, on aggregate, this budget represents, a 9% cut to all non-defense programs.
Oh.
Yeah. But that's sort of a misleading way to look at it, because when you look at the particulars, it becomes even more stark. And I'm going to do that right now. This budget would impose a 31% reduction in the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Well, we don't need that because there's no climate change.
That's exactly correct. 19% cut to the Department of Transportation.
Well, we don't need that because we don't want high-speed rail.
Yeah, we don't want any trains.
No trains.
18% to the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
No houses.
Affordable housing is not a problem. Just walk around Portland. Everybody's got a place to live.
Yeah, tents abound.
Oh, I know. We've got so much high-rise luxury housing. Everyone should be taken care of.
And feces abound.
12% cuts to agriculture, health and human services, the National Science Foundation, and the Department of Education.
We don't need no education.
Yep. I can go on and on and on. The department's receiving budget increases, commerce, veterans affairs, homeland security, and defense.
That's.
If budgets are moral documents, then this budget outlines just about everything you might expect. So there you have it. President Trump's budget for the coming fiscal year. I think before we go over to the Green New Deal, why don't we take a phone call?
One call.
Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, speaking of budgets, why don't you guys consider talking for a minute about the fact that every Republican we've had in office in the last 50 years has put us so far in debt that when they put a Democrat in there, they finally slowly work us out of debt. Get us back to where we're fiscally halfway responsible, and then another Republican comes in and puts us back in debt again.
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, and thank you very much for the call. Yeah, that's a very good point. This is a pattern that we've witnessed now over the change of many administrations going back to the times of my youth. under Ronald Reagan, that great saint who ushered in the end of the New Deal era, the post-war liberal consensus, and brought us to where we are today.
You know, Reagan was senile after he got shot.
I mean, may have been senile before that, too. But let's talk about this for just a second, right? Okay. The Republicans have donned and worn the mantle of fiscal conservatism and fiscal discipline forever and ever, right? That's who they are. They're the guys. They're the grown-ups. They're the guys who will be responsible with your money. They're not going to splash it around on all these programs helping the wrong sorts of people. I think we all know who I'm talking about when I say the wrong sorts of people, right?
Right.
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 They're the ones who will be fiscally responsible. But every time there's a Republican administration, the debt balloons beyond all recognition.
I wonder why that is.
Why? Because taxes are cut for the wealthiest Americans every single time the Republicans take office.
And they need that money.
Here's how the pattern plays itself out. Every time a Democratic administration, and I'm not trying to laud the Democrats or say that they are the answer to the country's woes, because really they're not, although we do need to work with them, and we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later. But they come into office, and all of a sudden, the deficit and the debt are the biggest, biggest emergencies facing the country. We can't pass the Affordable Care Act. It'll cost too much. We can't do any of these things. It'll cost too much. We can't enact Obama's stimulus legislation to rescue the global economy from the hole that conservatives threw it into. We can't do that because it'll cost too much money. That all of a sudden is the greatest overriding concern to face the Republic. And as soon as another Republican administration is elected, what do? They blow up the debt again. So what's interesting in this budget is that it seems to have finally done away with that pretense. There is not even a nod towards fiscal responsibility. There is not even an acknowledgement of any attempt to try and contain the amount of debt that we're adding to our balance.
You know, I know several people who were doing their taxes and they discovered that the money they were going to get back is smaller than it was before.
You're looking at one of them.
Hello.
Yes. My tax return is noticeably smaller than it was.
Our producer in the booth is saying it's true for him too.
Yeah.
That's three out of three.
This was Trump's working class tax cut, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I suppose, refreshing to see that this pretense is done away with. But I guarantee it, as soon as there is another Democrat elected to office, we're going to hear that old deficit drum being banged once again, because that's just how it works in this country.
Yes.
All right. So let's move on to the Green New Deal. First, a little background, Joe. What was the original New Deal? Tell us about it.
Oh, the original New Deal was a response to the crisis of the Great Depression. The Roosevelt administration trying many different ways, many of them successful, to build things like Social Security, to empower organized labor, and to, in general, produce a system which gave working people a fair deal, a New Deal.
And you could say this was built upon the gains achieved by the labor movement in the ensuing or the preceding decades.
No question about that.
Right. So what would you say, broadly speaking, the mechanism through which the New Deal operated? How did that work, fiscally speaking?
Well, it was a system that allowed for debt to be developed and then taken care of as people became more wealthy. That wasn't what you were looking for.
No, that wasn't what I was looking for.
What are you looking for?
I was looking for the creation of jobs, the creation of employment opportunities, the building of infrastructure through direct investment by the federal
government. Well, yes. In fact, that whole process went through both Democratic and Republican administrations, a clear up through and until Richard Nixon.
Yes, yeah. And finally,
I mean, we got highways, for goodness sake.
Right. The dagger was finally placed in its back by Reagan, as we mentioned a few years ago.
Well, he was a bad actor in every sense of the word.
He most definitely was a bad actor. But one of Franklin Roosevelt's closest economic advisors was a great economist, really a towering figure in the discipline, a guy by the name of John Maynard Keynes. Familiar with him?
Yeah.
He is the founder of what is unsurprisingly called the Keynesian School of Economics, which states that the best way to revive a struggling economy is to stimulate the demand side of the supply and demand continuum, right?
Right.
The best way to get things going again is to give people jobs so that they can have wages in their pockets, which will in turn go into their communities and spend.
Yeah.
It's called priming the pump was the metaphor.
Yes, and it worked.
Yes, it did work. Priming the pump was Roosevelt's metaphor for how this would all work. Interestingly, Trump a few weeks ago claimed that he invented the metaphor of priming the pump.
Trump is a cuckoo.
He is. And it worked. And it's really simple. It's something I think that even non-economists like myself can easily get their heads around. We all do better when we all do better. If for people are out there earning decent wages so that they can afford to buy things, so they can afford to purchase homes, so they can afford to purchase things like automobiles, it lifts all segments of the economy.
Yes.
It's truly the rising tide lifting all boats. And why does that work? Because everybody's got a boat. Under the conservative version of the rising tide, well, nobody's got a boat. There's only a few really big boats, and everybody else is swimming around hoping they can grab onto a piece of driftwood. That's the difference.
Yeah, but those are really big, big boats.
Those are really big, big boats.
They got gold entire.
Right, exactly. So to sum up, the New Deal was the federal government directly stimulating the economy through the creation of jobs and the paying of wages and the creation of large-scale infrastructure projects.
Right.
Now, I have to add an asterisk at this point. This was carried out in an age when we didn't fully understand the impact of industrialized economies on the ecosystem of the earth.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So much of what happened during the New Deal was done without any regard for its environmental consequences.
Correct.
Okay, so that's the first big asterisk. Second big asterisk that we need to consider going forward is that...
I used to date her.
A big asterisk?
Yeah.
Oh, well... I hope there were some exclamation points in your asterisk relationship.
Well, I can't discuss that on the air.
Okay, second big asterisk. The gains that were largely that were doled out during the New Deal were largely not shared in by communities of color.
Yeah.
This was true before the war. This was true after the war. For example, we've all heard of the GI Bill.
Yeah.
We've all heard of the... the home loans that were the returning GIs were able to obtain after the Second World War.
Right.
Communities of color participated in these things virtually not at all. So there was a significant segment of our populace that was left behind by these reforms.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that the Green New Deal that's being proposed now addresses directly. Let's take some more phone calls before we go any further. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Good, good. I heard a statistic on Trevor Noah the other night that just blew me away. Jeff Bezos is worth $144 billion.
True.
Yes.
And the guy, the comedian that was on, he was saying, do you know how long it would take you to spend that? Anyway, he said, if you spend $50 million a year, how many years will it take Jeff Bezos to spend his $144 billion?
I don't know.
He doesn't need $144 billion. Come on. It takes 2,880 years to spend that money at $50 million a year. Can you live on $50 million a year?
Yeah, I could sure as hell try.
Anyway, that's all I have to say.
Hey, thanks for the call.
You know, he brought up something that's tangentially related to this conversation, and that is the question of how much is enough.
Yeah.
That question is out of bounds in American political and economic discourse.
Can't have too much money.
We're not really allowed to ask that question.
Can't have too much money.
Because capitalists will tell you, if we all of a sudden decide how much is enough, then the whole system will fall apart and run into the ground.
Yeah.
Because without those who have an obscene amount already, unless they're able to strain for just a little bit more, the whole thing will fall to pieces.
Can't have too much
There's
money.
There's a word for that, but I can't say it on a family program like this. Let's go back to the phones. Dennis is next.
Yes, thank you very much. You were talking about, you know, the type of economics that Roosevelt had, Keynesian economics. Well, one of the other things you should mention is sort of some people think that the real power behind the throne was a woman named Frances Perkins, who was a Secretary of Labor.
I'm glad you mentioned her. She was quite a person.
I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit, because I don't know all that much, but I've heard a lot of things about her, and I wondered if you knew.
Well, I don't think we will right now, because we really want to get to the Green New Deal, but you made a very good point. She was a major contributor intellectually and elsewise to the New Deal.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for the call. He mentioned Keynesian economics, which we talked about a few minutes ago. I want to add one little bookend to that conversation. Keynesian economics is the economics of demand-side stimulus, as we explained. Put more money in people's pockets. The opposite viewpoint is what's known as supply-side economics. This is what Ronald Reagan ushered into the political mainstream, in which we have spent the last several decades trying to crawl out from under. And that is this notion that the economy will boom if you put money not in the pockets of the working class, but in the pockets of the ownership class, who will then turn around, because they are the job creators, they will turn around and use that money to build factories and do research and employ people and put everybody to work. And that money that the government gives them through lower taxes will trickle down to the rest of us, and everybody will do better.
Trickle down.
But I want to tell you that since 1980, when we really crossed that threshold into much, much lower high-end taxes for corporations and individuals, there is not one shred of evidence that supports supply-side economic theory. Not one. All right. No argument from you?
I can't think of
one. So, the Green New Deal. What has been proposed by the Congress, the Green New Deal, is not a new idea. It's been around for a while. There's various international organizations who have proposed something similar.
Well, what is it?
It is very much along the lines of President Roosevelt's New Deal. Massive government investment in infrastructure projects, in job creation, in stimulating the demand side of the economy. The difference is the overarching goal is not to extricate ourselves from the Great Depression, but to forestall and hopefully arrest the man-made change to the climate that the Earth is experiencing. Excuse me. So
that,
I mean,
that was a climate cough.
That was a climate cough, yeah. See, that was a global warming cough right there. That's the overarching goal of the Green New Deal. It is a pretty inclusive concept, and we're going to dig into that in just a second. And I think pretty exciting. Something, actually, that you and I have been talking about on this program for a long, long time. We've mentioned many times, if you're a capitalist, you really shouldn't resist this idea, because there is an awful lot of money to be made in the conversion away from fossil fuels to a renewable energy infrastructure. And that's what the Green New Deal proposes.
Right.
What makes this proposal interesting, I think, and what makes it truly meaningful, is that explicitly this proposal aims to share its bounty with everyone, particularly those communities who have traditionally borne the brunt of industrial pollution and, in more recent years, the deleterious effects of climate change. We're talking about the poor, communities of color, those people who, because of prevailing economic tides, are forced to live near coal-fired power plants, who are forced to live near major freeways as they make their way through urban areas. It is always the poor who have taken it in the teeth since the dawn of industrialization. And the Green New Deal explicitly aims to make life better for everybody and to share this prosperity much, much more equitably across the population than the original New Deal did.
And it's very important not to ignore the fact that it is environmentally sound planning. I mean, this is AOC. We love her.
We do. She's pretty great. So broadly speaking, you can break the Green New Deal down into three core principles. The first is we must decarbonize the economy. What does that mean? That we transition entirely away from the burning of fossil fuels by the year 2050.
Yeah, that old sun got nothing to do but roll around heaven all day and create power and heat and everything we need, because it's our sun.
Yeah, it's this giant fusion bomb that always shines on us all the time.
Well, so far.
Yeah, so far. And will for several billion years. Yeah.
So far.
I mean, we can argue about, well, you know, is this long-term plan, is it long enough to avoid the sun eventually burning out in several billion years? No, probably not. But it's good enough for the short term. Decarbonizing the economy. Getting the electricity sector to zero carbon as soon as possible, and all other sectors shortly thereafter. That is a huge, huge undertaking. Let us not sugarcoat this. This is a project larger than the mobilization for the Second World War, larger than and more focused than the effort to create the atomic bomb, larger and more focused than creating the space program in the United States.
Right.
This will dwarf all of these things. We have never undertaken something on this scale before in the history of our civilization, and possibly in the history of human civilization as we know it. We are so in the hole, so dependent on the combustion of fossil fuel and carbon-based energy resources, that it's going to take a massive, massive effort to get us out. And that's what this program calls for.
Well, it does, if I understand, it does two things. It creates full employment, three things: full employment, modernization of the infrastructure, and, in fact, deals with climate change.
Yeah, it does. And just to give you an idea of what exactly this will entail, I mean, first of all, we're talking about generating our electricity entirely from renewables. That in and of itself is a massive undertaking.
And let's point out, if you do that, it costs a lot, but once you've done it, it's free.
It's or mostly free.
Mostly.
Yeah. The other thing is disseminating green technologies into the marketplace and having them universally adapted. This means no more gas-burning cars on the road, period.
Oh, come on. That's period. What I got. I have to drive my little old...
Right. And what this means is, and then when people buy new vehicles, and people do, there's going to have to be incentives created to buy electric vehicles.
Yeah.
And that's going to mean massive government subsidies, both in their manufacture and distribution, and also helping people to purchase them.
But electric vehicles are quiet, and they can knock you off.
Yeah, they can, but I don't care about that. Because they don't put carbon into the air, and that is the most important part. Okay, so that's the first major plank of the Green New Deal. Let's take a phone call, and we'll go on to the next two. Joseph, good morning.
Hi, I appreciate you, very incisive. I own an all-electric car, and I will never buy another internal combustion vehicle. Easy to use, great, no maintenance. It's just wonderful. I kind of want to go a little off topic, if you don't mind. Charlie Hale was a previous mayor that we had that cut and run. He went on a world tour for a year. But I have a feeling that he sold us down the river to out-of-state developers, and a lot of the real estate money is leaving the state. And it's, you know, we're cutting our own bootstraps here if we're trying to lift ourselves up. Do you have an opinion on Charlie Hale and his administration and what happened to Portland?
Well, it's an interesting question, but it's way off topic. So I'm going to pass on it. Joseph, you raised a good question. What about Charlie Hale? But it ain't relevant right now.
Yeah, I would agree. That's something we'll have to tackle at a future date.
Yeah,
I think.
We'll beat up on Charlie later.
Okay. So this is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program. For those of you just tuning in, we are talking about and comparing and contrasting the contents of President Trump's new budget proposal and the proposed Green New Deal legislation in Congress.
Yeah, and the number to call, 231-8187.
Yep. Come up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio Universe author Shoshana Zuboff about her most recent book, Surveillance Capitalism.
A good book, I might add.
Oh, okay. At 10 on Flashpoints, there's an extended interview with poet and author Carolyn Forché. At 11, Stage and Studio presents a special documentary, Raising Cain, from the Crossing East Asian Pacific American History Series, winner of the 2006 Peabody Award. That's a very prestigious award.
Yeah.
Then at 11:30, Art Focused host Joseph Gallivan interviews painter Char Breschgold about her new show, Hold On, Let Go, at Golden Gallery in Beaverton. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yes.
Okay, so back to the Green New Deal.
Yes.
We were discussing decarbonizing the economy. I left out a very important part of this formulation.
What's that?
That is that the fact that buildings in which everybody lives and works, right?
Yeah, buildings.
Buildings.
You know.
They produce about 40% of annual U.S. carbon emissions.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, heat, cooling.
Yeah, heating, cooling, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So this is the Green New Deal. If we're going to decarbonize the economy, means extensive retrofitting and modernizing of virtually every building in the United States.
Well, wouldn't that mean jobs?
That would mean all kind of jobs, Joe. All kinds of jobs. All right. So there's that. Second major plank of the Green New Deal. The first, of course, decarbonizing the economy. The second, a federal jobs guarantee and large-scale public investments.
But that's socialism.
It's not. It is. Yes.
Socialism.
It's democratic socialism.
Oh,
and of course, if you paid any attention to the debate about this in Congress and on your TV and elsewhere, this is the club that Republicans and conservatives are using to beat this plan about the head. Socialism.
Communism.
They're trying to get rid of air travel and hamburgers. It's all going to go away.
Yeah.
Socialism. Oh, my God. It's so expensive.
The next thing you know, they'll be talking about high-speed rail.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So pay no attention to the guy shouting socialism because he's an old white guy, a conservative crank who's been saying the same thing for decades, and he doesn't understand what he's talking about. So pay no attention to that guy. Yes, I used masculine pronouns on purpose. Describe that guy.
Well, it's important to understand that you can have a economy which is very much a capitalist economy and still have a social democracy.
Yes, you can. I don't know how many times we have to drive this point home. I guess we have to continue to do so. You can still get rich in Sweden. You can still get rich in Denmark and in Japan and in Canada and all these places with some degree of a social democratic economy.
Yeah.
It doesn't represent the end of capitalism. Maybe the end of capitalism as we currently understand it. But I am here to submit to you today, listeners, that that's a good thing. We want to see the end of capitalism as we currently understand it.
Yes.
All right? Okay. So, federal jobs guarantee and large-scale public investments. We're talking about investments in a green power grid, power transmission and generation grid. We're talking about the construction of high-speed rail networks linking major urban centers.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy to have airplanes polluting the air and crashing and such.
You know, that's a big problem because air travel, it's hard to imagine the modern industrial economy without air travel.
Yeah.
Travel by jet airplane is one of the most polluting things you could possibly do as a consumer.
And the paranoid people who believe contrails are some kind of a plot.
Don't
call us about that.
No. So that's a problem. We're going to have to figure out a way to make air travel less carbon intensive than it is. Maybe we can bring back Zeppelins.
Oh, they are so cool.
Maybe, you know, traveling across Europe, maybe now it'll take a day and a half. But it'll be this nice, beautiful, peaceful ride on a Zeppelin.
Oh, that's so cool.
Wouldn't that be so cool?
So cool.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. We'll see. So large-scale investments, a federal jobs guarantee. And the third big plank of the Green New Deal is what people are calling a just transition. And that's what I was talking about a few minutes ago. Guarantees, explicit guarantees, that the bounty and the prosperity that this initiative will engender is shared broadly by the American populace, and that traditionally underserved and underrepresented populations are allowed to share in this prosperity. In other words, the Green New Deal represents a systemic effort to deconstruct white privilege and structural racism in the United States. Easy, right?
Well,
no problem.
Well.
So that's, in a nutshell, the Green New Deal. Now, I also have the text of the proposal itself, and it's important to remember that this is not a law as yet. This is what's called a resolution that gives what is known as the sense of the House. It did not pass the Senate. It did pass the House of Representatives, and it lays out broadly how and what or what this proposal wants to achieve and how it's going to get there. And if you can look down into the details, such as they are at this point, and you'll find just exactly how they propose to address all these problems.
And you should go online and look at it.
Congress.gov, I highly recommend it. It's an inspirational piece of reading.
Yeah.
Even though it's just a summation of what this, you know, a broad sketch of what this initiative might look like, it still represents something that's far more enlightened than anything I've ever seen come out of the United States Congress.
And the point here is to move to a progressive, small p,
yes,
economy and system.
Yeah.
And I want to make it clear, this don't take money away from the rich.
Well, in a sense it does.
Huh?
In a sense it does.
Because they get taxed more.
They get taxed more, yeah. This is not going to mean that you stop being rich. It's going to mean that some members of the supremely obscenely rich caste are a little less supremely obscenely rich. That's what it means.
Would they notice the difference?
Well, I'm sure they would, and I'm sure it would keep them up at night. But now ask me if I care. I don't
care.
I don't care.
You don't care.
No. That's what this means. It will absolutely, that in fact, opposition to this measure, usually the first thing out of somebody's mouth is, well, it's so damn expensive, how are you going to pay for it? And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other supporters of the Green New Deal, I think, have what I think is a really intelligent rejoinder, which is, nobody ever asks how much the next war is going to cost.
Really?
Nobody ever asks how much these tax cuts are going to cost us.
Well, we're already beginning to feel the impact of that.
Yeah, we are. But when somebody asks how much is this going to cost, I think the best rejoinder to that question is, who cares? We'll figure it out. We have no other choice. In less than 12 years, the temperature will have risen globally on average 2 degrees centigrade over pre-industrial levels. That indicates a point of no return for the climate. Catastrophic results, massive displacement of populations, shortages of water, changes in global weather patterns, wars and increasing conflicts over diminishing resources, particularly fresh water. This is what we're looking at. We don't have a choice. It doesn't matter how much this costs. Some of you may think that's a wildly irresponsible statement, but I'm telling you, it doesn't matter. This is something we have to do. And if you're able to look past that, it's clear that the price tag is going to become irrelevant because of the general prosperity, how we're all going to prosper with the jobs and the projects that this initiative entails.
I think it's great. I think we should. I think we should go to the phones. 231-8187.
Mike. Good morning.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hey, fine. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I was just wondering, I haven't heard anything on the Green New Deal about animal agriculture.
It's in there.
It is. I just don't hear anybody talking about it and how what a big impact it is compared to transportation.
Now, are you talking about the fact that if people on a large scale were to adopt a vegetarian or near vegetarian diet, it would make a huge difference in combating
exactly.
global warming? Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the proposal that came out of the House addresses this. It doesn't really talk specifically how that's going to. Here's what it says. Working collaboratively with farmers and ranches in the United States to remove pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from the agricultural sector as much as is technologically feasible, including by supporting family farming, by investing in sustainable farming and land use practices that increase soil health, and by building a more sustainable food system that ensures universal access to healthy food. I think you can read between the lines there and find a push towards a more widespread adoption of vegetarianism. It's not explicitly spelled out.
Well, but
right.
beyond the question of vegetarianism, the fact of the matter is that the meat we eat is way too fat itself.
It's true, yeah.
And it's fattened up for profit.
It's too resource intensive to produce. But I'm sorry, go ahead, caller. Continue.
No, we lost him.
We lost him.
I'm
okay.
Sorry
about that. So it's in there, but like a lot of the tenets of this proposal, the fine grained details have yet to be worked out. But again, that's okay. That's okay. This is how those conversations begin. This is how legislation eventually is crafted. Somebody's got to put out a broadly sketched proposal of how things are going to look, and then we hammer out the details.
Well,
that's how it works.
And I think one of the things that's really weird about where we're at, there's no question, if you're rational and if you look around, that we're facing an enormous worldwide crisis, and the solution to that crisis has to be the cooperation of every nation state and every person in the planet.
Yep.
Otherwise, we're going to be swimming.
Yeah. And it also means that the people at the top of the global economic pyramid right now, the people who benefit most from industrial capitalism as we understand it, their position will be threatened. Their preeminence will be diminished. The way that they traditionally have made money will be rendered obsolete.
And
they are going to have to adapt along with the rest of us.
I think this is really an important movement. I think it has legs. I think it can be done. It's not outside the realm of possibility. But with the current weird Republican Party, with the turtle in charge of the Senate, I mean, it's going to be hard. So let's go to the phones. 231-8187. I think a guy named Joe is on the air.
Joe, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, there's already a business model out there that will solve a lot of this problem. It's called the numeral one.
Mm-hmm.
oneworker1vote.org.
Oh, I don't know this site.
They're an offshoot of the Mondragon worker-owned cooperative. They're global. They're setting up environmental solution manufacturing, and the workers own the company. Split the profits.
This sounds like something coming out of Spain long ago.
Well, Mondragon.
Ah, I was right.
This is an offshoot of the Mondragon American Partners person. They've got, you get online and look at all the stuff they're doing. And they're very much focused on a Green New Deal in terms of manufacturing, but they're doing it in a way that promotes the workers. One worker, one, the numeral one, one worker, one vote. org.
Well, thank you. We will check it out.
This is at least 50% of the solutions. The other 50% is technology, but we're working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a good day. Thanks for the show.
Thanks for the call.
Now, you mentioned the evil turtle in charge of the Senate.
Yeah, the evil turtle.
Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
Do you think it's unfair to call him a turtle? I like turtles. They're cute.
No. In fact, I think he is one of the most morally bankrupt and complicit villains in the current mess we find ourselves in. He's the worst.
I'm not going to spend time on this, but something really went seriously wrong with the Republicans from their sort of original conservative base to today. Something really creepy has happened. And he's the absolute synthesis of that weirdness.
Yeah, that guy's awful. You know what he's trying to do?
No.
He wants to bring the Green New Deal resolution to a vote this week. And do you think he's doing it because he believes in it?
No.
No. He's doing it to try to beat liberals about the head with it, accuse them of being socialists, and drive a wedge between the emerging progressive wing of the Democratic Party and its more cautious, more mainstream elements.
Well, this is, from my perspective, a great challenge. The Democratic Party has always compromised away its progressiveness. And now is an opportunity. We've got these young people, the smart people in the Congress, and it's possible to re-establish a progressive agenda for the Democratic Party. But the details are where people are getting caught up and getting hijacked, and it's really sad to see. For example, we don't need to decide right now how we're going to give universal health care. We don't need to decide whether it's going to be a government program that says or a government program that says. We need to decide to do it and then to work it out.
Yeah, that's precisely it. Yeah, but he's going to do his damnedest to obstruct that any way he possibly can.
Yeah.
And it doesn't just apply to the Green New Deal legislation. Yesterday, for example, in the Senate, Senator Schumer brought forward a resolution to demand that the Attorney General turn over the Mueller report in its entirety.
That's reasonable.
Yeah, McConnell blocked it and never came to a vote.
Yeah.
Because that's just what he does. And he also steals Supreme Court seats from sitting presidents. He does that too.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Green New Deal, I think, represents something that progressives have carried around in their hearts for a long time. Indeed, this is something that I have devoutly wished for and advocated for years now. It is a clear way out of the dilemma we're in now. If we're going to find our way out of from underneath global warming, without cataclysmic results. And really, if we're talking honestly about this, we're probably not. The best we're going to be able to do is mitigate the worst of it at this point.
Maybe even that is impossible.
But we still need to do it. We still need to muster this effort to do it. And the fact that the first serious proposal to do so is also committed to ensuring that we do so in a socially just manner and in an economically just manner, you know, that really gives me some hope that we can find our way out of this thing.
And a scientifically reasonable manner.
It is a heavy lift. Please don't misunderstand me. This is going to mean radical departures from the way of life that many of us have taken for granted for years and years. The way we have lived our lives is going to change dramatically. And that's not an easy thing for a lot of people to accept. But that's what this is going to take.
It's either that or learning how to have gills.
Okay, that takes several million years.
I think so.
But yeah, that's what's going on. So what is your take, broadly speaking, on this?
Well, look, I at this point in my political and social life, social democracy seems to me to be the necessary compromise to build a good and healthy society. And particularly considering the onrushing reality of global warming, this seems to me to be a very practical way of addressing these problems. It's going to cost a lot of money, but it's our money. And it's going to have to be done. And I'm surprised, actually, that these Bezos and these other guys aren't really behind it, because they got lots and lots of billions of dollars, and they, too, will suffer as a consequence of global warming. So it combines both the reasonable fear of what's happening in the environment with a serious effort to build social justice. So my answer, I like the Green New Deal.
Yeah, and it's something we should have started a long time ago. It would have been easier to forestall the damaging effects of climate change if we had mounted an effort like this 30 years ago. But we didn't, and here we are. Yes, it's going to be expensive. Yes, it's going to call for a massive overhaul of our system of taxation and distribution of revenue. Yes, it's going to take many things that violate or that are anathema to right-wing economic dogma.
Which, by the way, is superstitious.
Right. But really, I don't really care. Yeah. I don't really care about any of that. It's just something we have to do. We have no choice. This is our future.
I think I agree
with
you.
If we don't do it, we are consigning ourselves to a post-apocalyptic wasteland of a planet.
Look, we're facing an onrushing crisis in the environment. And it is not a political issue. It is a reality issue of the environment. If we want to deal with this, we need to deal with it in a reasonable way. And the only equitable way to do this is to figure out a system that essentially turns our attention to the needs of everyone in the planet. Otherwise, we're going to have massive, you think the migration issue is an issue now? You just wait. Starving people don't really want to be nice about it because they're starving.
No. And consider where we live here in the Pacific Northwest. We are fortunate enough to have an abundance of clean, fresh water.
So far.
Yeah, that could in itself change. Or things elsewhere could change enough such that a whole lot of people want to come live here because there's water you can drink and bathe with and all this other stuff that we use water for every day. So one of the biggest problems we're facing right now, in addition to the political obstacles we described, is that, and this is going to, this is interesting. There's a poll conducted, or a survey from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communications, conducted late last year, that shows that the Green New Deal commands majority support amongst registered voters.
Majority support?
A huge majority support. Among all registered voters, 81% of people support the Green New Deal.
Wow.
Among Democrats, that's 92%. Among Republicans, it's 64%. So even registered Republicans support what this is about. I suspect that given how much wealth has been concentrated in this country, that the notion of abundant jobs is appealing even to political conservatives. But when you step back and ask the larger question, 82% of Americans know nothing at all, and that is a direct quote, nothing at all about what the Green New Deal is.
Wow, we need a massive advertising campaign.
Yes, and apparently we need more people to register to vote. So yeah. Yes, a massive advertising and public relations campaign, an educational campaign is required to make this a reality.
You know, one of the things that puzzles me is why the rich don't want the Green New Deal, because it's the only thing that's going to save them from the same thing that's going to destroy all of us.
Yeah, I guess they're unable to see that.
Well, they probably think they can float around, you know, on big boats.
Political tribalism is a big part of this, Joe.
Yeah.
The lefties want it, therefore I don't want it.
Well, and it's, again, it's this bugaboo which we have faced ever since Roosevelt, really, the bugaboo of the notion of socialism or communism or whatever, which is an abstraction that has no validity in this situation.
Right, especially, and this is the real irony, among young people who are probably going to be the ones who are going to rescue us all from the consequences of our own excess. Young people, when they hear the word socialism, they don't think totalitarian, Soviet-style, top-down socialism. They think of Denmark. They think of Sweden. So it's the word is not, it doesn't carry the same sting with young people that it does for lots of members of the older generation.
Yeah, I mean, we're still under the dark shadow of the Cold War, really.
Yeah, that's true. And we're also, we should face the fact that it's your generation that wrecked the world, Joe.
Marina
is next. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just calling, actually, you just touched on this with the idea of an advertising campaign. You know, I agree with everything you guys are saying. A lot of people that I'm close to also agree. But there are a lot of people out there that are either in a huge state of denial or apathy that the world is in the state it's in or that we really don't have much time. And we see things like the Occupy movement and these huge gestures towards changing things. And then they kind of, I don't know where they go, but it blows my mind, I say this all the time, that we still drive gasoline cars. I mean, it's 2019. Mm-hmm. That's crazy to me. So when I look at this, I really think, you know, how can I reach out to people who spend their days, I don't know, buying brand names and playing video games and ignoring what's happening.
Well, we have to have, look, we have to have a realistic cultural change. It's the kind of cultural change that has is not easy to build. But remember, in the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and others made changes possible that have had lasting and positive impact. Now is time to look at things again in a reasonable way. And we do have the technologies to reach out to many people. I don't know that it's going to work, but existentially, good word here, we must try or we are all doomed. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go because we're really running out of time, and I appreciate the call.
Yeah, we've really got no choice. It's going to be more expensive to do nothing.
Yeah, but we may all grow gills.
Here's hoping. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be back at you next week.
From those nads in Tiananmen Square, it's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly real.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Self Portrait in Bloom with Nilofer Taleby on Tuesday, April 2nd from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Portland State University Lincoln Recital Hall in Portland. In the aftermath of World War II, a new dynamism was taking shape in Persian poetry. In this talk, award-winning translator Nilofer Taleby explains how Iranian poets were increasingly instrumental in freeing Persian poetry from a state of decline and stagnation. Again, that's Self-Portrait in Bloom with Nilofer Taleby on Tuesday, April 2nd from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the Portland State University Lincoln Recital Hall, 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up this morning on KBOO Next on Alternative Radio, they interview author Shoshana Zuboff about her most recent book, Surveillance Capitalism. At 10 on Flashpoints, it features an extended interview with poet and author Carolyn Forché. At 11, Stage and Studio presents a special documentary, Raising Cain, from the Crossing East Asian Pacific American History Series, winner of the 2006 Peabody Award. Then at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Galavan interviews painter Shar Breschgold about her show Hold On, Let Go at Golden Gallery in Beaverton. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm. And